Thank you, Dave and Ben, for that. And just a reminder, as we come into Holy Week here at Nexus, some things we've got coming up. We'll be here on Friday for a Good Friday service. We're going to look at Jesus' fourth and final saying of the cross. So I hope you'll join us on Good Friday, 10:30 a.m. here as we remember such a significant day in the history. And then, of course, Easter Sunday, we're doing something a little odd, a little different. It's called The Funeral for Death, and I'm very excited about it. It's a play that I wrote. So that could be weird, but I hope that you will join us for that, because I'm hoping Easter Sunday will again be a day that gives us the ability to look at Easter perhaps with a fresh set of eyes. And so mark those two dates in your calendar. I hope that you will join us and make this part of your Easter weekend. Jesus' sixth saying in John 19, a jar of wine vinegar was there, so they soaked a sponge in it, put the sponge on a stalk of the hyssop plant, and lifted it to Jesus' lips. When he had received the drink, Jesus said, "It is finished." And with that, he bowed his head and gave up his spirit. Jesus utters the sixth saying from the cross right as he is about to breathe his last breath, and he simply moans out, "It is finished." And the idea here being that the goal has been accomplished, it has been reached, the goal that Jesus had been working towards his entire ministry from the very beginning has now been attained. He has followed the path faithfully all the way to death. It is now finished, done. As the writer of Philippians remarks, he humbled himself by becoming obedient to death, even death on a cross. And so as Jesus is about to die, he signs off with a sort of mission accomplished statement. But I think, of course, the obvious question coming from this statement is, well, what was the mission? What was the goal exactly? What exactly is finished? And if what happened on the cross was such a big deal, if it's really a history-changing event, well then why, given the state of the world, why do things look so obviously not finished? I think those are great questions. I don't want to press into them this morning. But I want to show you a house on my street. This is a house on my street. Scaffolding, ladders, tarps on the roof, and it's been like that for 6 years. And I remember when we first moved into our house, I saw the guy whose house it is. He was working on his roof. He said, "Yeah, you're doing some work there." He said, "Yeah, it's basically finished." And 6 years later, here he is. I don't know what this guy is up to, odd little fella. But this house looks far from finished, even though 6 years ago, he told me it was basically finished, he said. And I feel like this is what it can feel like, look like, when we concentrate on the cross and when Jesus says these words, "It is finished." It's like, well, it doesn't exactly look like that. The world is still full of scaffolding and tarps, leaks everywhere. What exactly is going on? What is finished? And I think we have to first begin exploring that question by reminding ourselves of John's artistry. John's gospel is an extraordinary canvas. It's a work of art that functions on multiple layers, multiple meanings. And of course, John's gospel begins with the words, "In the beginning," which is a not so subtle hint that whatever he's up to in his gospel is going to have some parallels with the Genesis creation account. And so to understand this work of art, we have to sort of step back from it, see the greater whole, look back into Genesis, look around at earlier episodes in John to sort of pick up what he's talking about here. And so that's what I want to do. And I think the first thing to say is this: John wants us to know that these words of Jesus, what he's trying to say here is what is finished is Jesus' mission of conquest and deliverance. But this mission of conquest is not about overthrowing Rome, as some supposed, in some sort of typical military fashion. The mission is more cosmic in nature. And Jesus knows that the Romans of the time, they're really just puppets. They aren't the real enemy. And so when Jesus dies and says it is finished, what John has in mind is conquest and deliverance on a cosmic level. That's what's finished. And it raises the questions even more urgently, I think. Well, what exactly does that look like? What exactly does that mean? Well, I think at least three things. Jesus finishes these three things. First, the systems of our world are placed on trial, judged, found guilty and wanting. Second, the Satan is defeated and driven out. Third, Jesus finishes one story so that another story can now begin. And that probably sounds vague. And so what I want to do this morning is explore these three ideas through images. The images of a trial, a mouse trap, and a table. I'll jump into a trial. I don't know about you, but I've always wanted to be in a trial. Well, not the one being tried, I suppose, but Kristen's friend just got called to jury duty, and that has been like on my bucket list. I would love to be on a jury sometime in my life. I think that would be a load of fun. I was in a trial or a pre-trial once. When I was 18, I was a horrible driver. I got in like four accidents. My dad couldn't stand it. It was bad. One accident, I came to a four-way stop. I stopped. I pulled out into the intersection and boom, someone hit me on the side. It wasn't too serious. A little dent in my car, a little thing in their fender. It wasn't too bad. But 2 months later, I got a letter in the mail telling me that I was being sued for $2 million. And I was 18 and I was like, huh. Making like $685 at my minimum age. And I'm like, that seems like a lot of money. Called the insurance company and said, don't worry, we'll take care of it. Just keep your phone on. We'll tell you what's going on. And so they called me one day and say, you got to come down to a pre-trial. I'm like, oh, all right. I was nervous. I went, I met with, I guess it was a lawyer or somebody from the insurance company. Told me, we go in the room. They'll ask you some questions. There's a little typewriter person taking down your notes. Just go, tell your story, defer to me, and you'll be all right. I said, all right. So I go in there, they start asking me questions. What happened? I came to the four-way stop. Then what? Then I went through and got hit. And at one point, I was telling me a story, and I said, I guess I didn't look both ways. And immediately, my lawyer jumped up and said, don't record that. Don't record that. Strike that from the record. He didn't mean to say that. I'm like, oh, no. And he was kind of nervous. Like, no, he didn't say that. And I was talking to him after. He's like, what are you doing? You can't incriminate yourself. Just stick to the story. Let me do the fine walking. And the interesting thing is I left that day and I never heard anything else again. My insurance hasn't gone. I guess, whatever. They settled. But I was so fascinated by this idea that whoever it was that I was with, some insurance guy, the truth of the matter didn't seem to really be the priority. It didn't really matter if the truth was, I didn't look both ways. That was what happened. It was sort of framing the story. And we have an interesting occurrence in the Gospel of John prior to Jesus going to the cross. It starts with a trial, with a courtroom image. And so the cross is really a trial taking place. And it takes place when Jesus stands before Pilate in John 18 to 19, and John hints at a subtle shift that occurs throughout this trial, throughout the scene, because it starts to feel like Pilate might actually be the one standing trial. Pilate, of course, for John, represents not just the Roman Empire, he represents empire itself. He represents the whole system of ruling, the way human systems play out. And so John hints at a switch here. Is Pilate trying Jesus or is Jesus trying Pilate? Is Pilate judging Jesus or is Jesus judging Pilate? And again, for John, there are always echoes of Genesis in his gospel. And so Pilate represents the way the world has been run since the very beginning, since the very first city that was built. It is the way of Cain that is on trial here. It's interesting, in the book of Genesis, the very first human structure, human city, is built by Cain. Cain, of course, in Genesis 2, he kills his brother. And when God goes looking for him, Cain won't admit he's even his brother. What Cain does is take his brother and redefines him as enemy. And I believe from that very early story, we have the heart of every human ideology. Take other humans and redefine them as enemy. And for Cain, the only way he can have power and domination is by killing his brother. And when he does, he then goes out and founds the very first human city. He founds human civilization, and in doing so, he sets up the pattern that we run by. Make others an enemy, kill them, tells lies about it. For Cain, Abel had to go. It was the way of progress. I have to get rid of him. And so Pilate becomes the heir of this way. He embodies the whole philosophy of power and ruling. And all of it is placed on trial and is exposed for what it is on the cross. It's exposed. Pilate becomes the heir. And what I think Scripture wants us to know is that Satan, the Satan, we've talked about this before, the Satan has always ruled the world through human systems of domination, exploitation, and violence. And what Jesus is conquering and delivering us from is that. And now it's finished. And the interesting thing is this, as Jesus stands trial, there's this interesting moment because Jesus says to Pilate, I have come to bear witness to the truth. And in that moment, Pilate scoffs, what is truth? But the interesting thing is Pilate returns to him with truth, his truth. He comes back to Jesus and he really thinks Jesus is just, he's innocent but a fool. And so he comes back to Jesus with his truth. And this is what he says to Jesus. Do you not know that I have power to release you and power to crucify you? This is his truth. I have the power to kill you, Jesus. This is the truth of the world, Jesus. Don't you get it? The world runs by power. The world is run by the powerful, by those who have the power to kill, by those who have the power to silence, by those who have the power to legislate, by those who have the power to decide what is right and wrong, by those who have the power of bigger weapons. That's the truth. And it always has been. This is the way the world is run. And we still believe it. Nothing's changed in our mentality. Think of our discourse. How has the world changed? By who we vote into power. By which groups have power. And for the question for us today is rarely, how has the world run? We know how it runs. It runs on power. The question is, who has it? And so even today, that truth, that power runs the world still runs rampant in us. This is what Pilate says to Jesus. The world runs by power and I have it. The world is a contest for power, and those that have it win. And Jesus says that's a lie. That is, in fact, not how the world is run. And so there's a trial playing out. Jesus says, you've made your case, Pilate. Now I will make mine by going to the cross. And I will die in weakness. And I will die forgiving enemies. And so he does. His case in the trial is made on the cross by dying, expressing love for enemies, living the truth of the Sermon on the Mount right to the very end. The cross is a trial scene playing out in front of us. Pilate and the world make their case, and then Jesus goes to the cross to make his case. And when Jesus says it is finished, it's akin to the prosecution saying, we rest our case. And all that's left to happen now is for the Supreme Court of Heaven to make a ruling, and it will on Easter Sunday morning. And on the surface, what we see on the cross is Jesus is stripped naked and shamed, but John is working creative magic because what's really stripped naked and shamed is human structures of power in their naked lust for domination. And they're placed on trial and found guilty and wanting. What is finished on the cross is Jesus' case that the world can be run through love expressed through forgiveness, not power and domination. That's what's finished. And yet it's still hard to believe. No. The world runs by power. Still haven't processed it yet, but Jesus makes his case, and the verdict on Easter Sunday morning is no, there's a reality deeper than playing politics, playing power. There's a deeper reality to this world, and it's one of love expressed through forgiveness. But it's more. The cross is also a trap. Yesterday, Kristen said to me, I think we got a little problem. So what's the problem? She said, there's a hole in the house outside. So what? So I went and I looked at the side of my house and there's a gaping hole under my house. It's about that big. I'm like, that's not a small problem. That's a big problem. I don't know what this is going on. So I decided to consult my neighbor, Mike Strathdy, who is a wonderful man. I would describe him as a mix between Mr. Rogers and Steve Irwin. He knows animals and plants and stuff, and he's really friendly. And I said, "Mike, would you come here and take a look? I think I got a problem." And he said, "Yeah, that looks like a problem." And as he started examining the hole, he's like, "Well, it's too big for a rat. I don't think that's a rat down there." He said, "Could be a raccoon, but they generally go up." He's like, "I think you got a skunk under your house." "Yeah. A skunk?" He's like, "Yeah, I've been smelling skunk." I'm like, "God, jeez, what am I going to do?" He said, "Well, you got one of two options. You can pay money, have someone remove it." He's like, "I got a simpler, better option." I'm like, "Really? What's that?" He said, "In my shed, I got a trap." In his shed, there's everything in his shed. Like, you just say, "Hey, you got a ping pong table?" He's got a ping pong table, and he has everything in his shed. And he's like, "I got a trap. We'll trap it." I said, "Well, how is that going to work?" He said, "It's simple if you know what you're doing." And I said, what about this makes it look like I know what I'm doing? I have no clue what I'm doing." He said, "It's simple. We set the trap. The skunk goes in. You approach it with a sheet. You put it over the skunk, put it in your trunk, drive it to the country, let it go." "Not a chance am I doing that. That sounds like a disaster written all over it." Anyway, he and I are scheming. If I'm not here next Sunday, it's because I got sprayed by a skunk and I'm soaping down or something. He's like, "Set a trap." "Really?" And this is what's going on. The cross is a trap. It's interesting because, what's his name? St. Augustine, sorry. In speaking of the cross, he says, "The cross is the devil's mousetrap." What does he mean by that? The Christus Victor understanding of the cross, which was the dominant understanding of the cross for the first 1,000 years of the church, this idea, this understanding of the cross is that what is accomplished on the cross is Jesus liberates us from sin and death and the devil. And so Jesus drives Satan out. And for Augustine, that works in the same way that a mousetrap works. It goes like this. From the very beginning, Satan is trying to thwart Jesus, trying to trip him up. We see that early, even at his birth, but of course in his temptation. Satan is trying to get Jesus to trip up, and no matter what Satan does, he can't get it to work. And so Satan decides to kill Jesus. Let's just get rid of this guy. And we see this at the Last Supper. We're told that when Judas leaves, Satan enters his heart. So this seems to be Satan's idea, and it works. He gets Jesus killed. And since Satan owns death and hell, he takes care of this Jesus guy. And for Augustine, this is Satan taking the cheese, so to speak. Because what Satan doesn't know is this Jesus guy is just not another human being. This is God in the flesh. And so we have a bit of a Trojan horse thing going on here. He's taken Jesus into death, taken Jesus into Hades. The enemy, though, is now inside, behind the gates of hell. And there, the conquest and deliverance occurs. Jesus takes the keys of death and Hades, and everyone whose story could only possibly end in death, which is all of us, is now released from the certain future. And this is the idea behind the harrowing of hell that we talked about a few weeks ago. Satan takes the cheese. Jesus descends into hell, and suddenly the mousetrap snaps. Got him. And I totally get it. This sounds so odd and fantastical and far-fetched and downright mythological. And it is. We're dealing in metaphor around the great mystery that is the cross. All these writers have to deal with this metaphor. But I love this story, this image. I think it's rich and compelling. It's outlandish. But its outlandishness to me is part of its key. You have to have eyes to see the logic and power of the cross. It seems foolish and silly, but Paul reminds us the cross always sounds like foolishness to a world that continues to believe the lie that power is what runs the world. And Satan cannot see how possibly this weakness, this cross, something that looks so weak, could possibly contain within it power. And so he takes the cheese and snap. God is redefining the rules here. And because God is love, God is weak. Satan takes the bait because power preys on weakness. His whole existence is predicated on making others weaker and preying on that through power and violence. But the Satan overreaches here. Because what looks like the cheese of weakness to the eyes of the world, Jesus hanging on the cross, it's actually the power and kingdom of God. And to me, this starts to make sense of the question, why don't things look better in this world? Why? Why does the world not seem finished? I get asked that question a lot. I've asked myself that question a lot. If this Jesus thing is really true, then why doesn't the world look better? Why are we still mired in the mud and muck of war and violence and greed and hate? If Jesus finished something on the cross, why doesn't it look that way? Why is the world such a mess? And I think when we ask those questions, we betray how we really believe the world works. Because when we ask those questions, what we're exposing ourselves as is people who want God to act in power. Come on, God. Come in power and might and start knocking some people around. Be the Boston Bruins of the cosmos. Start wielding the sword. Intervene and clean up this mess. But that would be just the same old story, wouldn't it? That would be the same old story of Cain and Pilate with a different leader. And I believe this is why God doesn't use power in this world. Because a God that starts intervening and kicking ass, enforcing his rule, starts to look a little bit like Satan. We don't need another empire run by power and might. We've seen that. We've tried it over and over again. What we need is a new kingdom. This is why Jesus says, my kingdom's not of this world. Don't you get it? It's unlike anything you've ever known. It's a kingdom of weakness. A kingdom of love expressed through forgiveness. And so when Jesus says it is finished, what is finished is the idea that the world is run by power, force, coercion, violence, domination, death. And because that story is ending, Jesus is beginning a new story. On the cross, Jesus finishes one story so that another story can now emerge. And there are intentional echoes of Genesis here. If you recall the account in Genesis, God goes to work on creation. And notice this, the first time the word finished is mentioned in the Bible is in Genesis 1:31, which says this, God saw everything that he had made, and indeed it was very good, and there was evening and there was morning, the sixth day. Thus the heavens and the earth were finished in all their multitude. And on the seventh day, God finished the work that he had done, and he rested on the seventh day from all the work that he had done. God creates the world and finishes on the sixth day, which in the Jewish calendar, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, it is finished. Jesus dies on the cross and utters, it is finished. The work of creating a new creation is done. And then God rests on the seventh day, and Jesus rests and lays in a tomb on the seventh day, Saturday, which means Sunday is a new week. It's the beginning of something brand new, a new work, a new creation, a new story. And on Easter Sunday, that's the beginning of a brand new story, a story the world has never even heard the likes of. And we are invited to be part of the story that's emerging. This is what Paul's getting at. 2 Corinthians says, if anyone is in Christ Jesus, behold, a whole new creation, a whole new story is now playing out. A new work has begun, a whole new week, a whole new work is beginning. And when we find ourselves drawn into the orbit of the cross, we are made a new story. Our lives are to tell a new story that says, no. Power and domination and violence, that's not how the world works at its essence, its core, because a new story has begun. That old one is finished. So Easter's a whole new story, a whole new week. And if you choose to travel the Christian path, you are part of that story. What is finished? The story of the world being run by power and force through violence and domination. Whole new world has been born. Whole new way has emerged that proclaims, no, it's love expressed through forgiveness. That's how the world spins. And Jesus resists temptation all the way through his life. He forgives, remains true. He absorbs the psychological feeling of being abandoned. He absorbs suffering, takes the worst of power, the worst of domination, absorbs it all. And at the end, when he says it is finished, all he has to do now is die. Just breathe his last and then wait for the verdict. And so Jesus dies, mission accomplished. He's made his case for love over power and awaits the verdict. He set the trap and heard it snap around the neck of Satan. And those acts open a new space, a new territory. And it's this story that I constantly want to invite us into. I want to invite us into the story this morning at the table. And as you come this morning and simply dip bread into wine, I'm simply going to say to you, the body of Christ broken for you, the blood of Christ shed for you. And in those words are the beginning of a new story for you, for us, for the world. Take the bread and wine and be welcomed into a new story, because behold, a whole new creation. And when we do this, as you do this, if you should choose to do this, because we never want any pressure on anyone here to ever have to feel like they have to take these elements. But if you should choose to, what you are saying is this: I don't want to be part of that old story anymore, because it's finished. As you dip the bread into the wine, what you're doing is saying, I want to be part of the new story, the true story, Jesus' new path for the world. Instead of choosing power, we choose love expressed through forgiveness. And you know, I get it. This ritual can seem silly. I know it can feel odd. I know it can feel bizarre. But I want to show you why this ritual is so powerful and why it is where the new story begins to play out. I want to show you what I think might be the most beautiful photo of a table I've ever seen. This is a photo taken in Juarez, Texas, a border town on the border with Mexico. And it's a church celebrating Eucharist together, but they've been divided by a wall. And I find this so incredibly touching and moving. They're divided by a border wall. And you know, these are the stories that dominate the headlines. Stories of walls and division and fear and hate and power playing out in the media all the time. That's the story. That's the way the world works. We set up walls. That's what power does. But there's another story playing out, and it never catches the attention of the media. It's the story of people who say, a wall can't divide us. So you can put up your wall, but that won't stop us from breaking bread. Because we believe the true story playing out is love expressed through forgiveness. It's an act, a ritual that says stories of walls are not the real story. Stories of power, that's not the real story. Stories of playing politics and trying to change the world through that, no, this is how the world has changed. People coming together through a wall and saying, we will break bread and wine together. I believe God is at work in this world, but the work God is doing is often so small, so weak looking, so hidden away from the eyes of media and headlines. But it's these small acts, communion across the walls of separation, communion here between people divided in our own ways, that announce there's a new story. And it continues to testify the way of power and force and violence and domination. That one's done. All we have to do now is live into the new story. Love expressed through forgiveness. And so as you come to the table, I simply want to ask you a question. Would you be willing to believe this new story is true? Would we be willing to give up our need for power, our need to dominate? Would we be willing to believe that the world doesn't spin because of power or fear, but because of love and forgiveness? If so, come, take a piece of bread, dip it into wine, and be told, the blood of Christ shed for you, the body of Christ broken for you. So I want to ask you to come now. Marie will be at this table. I'll be at this table. The band will then play us out after we've all done. But I trust that this act this morning is not simply a ritual, but an act of trust, an act of faith, that the world is being run by a new story. Come now, if you will.